A masquerade ball was something else. It sounds, amazing. It's Trudy's thing. I depillowed and turned, settling the bits of me that needed it as carefully as possible. Trudy. She muttered something. Huh?
My mother.
Her already husky voice had acquired that weed horse edge, so she sounded like Lauren Bacall in a bad mood. You call your mother Trudy? She glanced up, her strange blue-green eyes sparkling.
Textbook, aren't I?
I'm not your counselor. She unfolded her legs and climbed off the bed, boot buckles jingling, took the final drag of her joint and then vanished with the roach. Truthfully, I was relieved she didn't just throw it onto the carpet or something. As soon as she was out of sight, I shot out of bed, pulled on a pair of boxers and the biggest T-shirt I had, which I got at a John Grant concert, and the only size they'd had left was apparently elephantine. It said Calipigian on it, with the definition underneath. Nick had bought it for me, since it definitely applied. I was trying to bring order to my hair, which had assumed its usual sleeping position of every fucking where, when Ellery came back. She lingered in the doorway, towing at the wall in a not-quite-kicking-it way.
"I didn't know where you'd gone,"
she said finally. I blinked. Home? I mean, back to Kinloch Bearvey, where my family live.
Did he hurt you? Is that why you had to leave?
Well, kind of. Her hands clenched into fists, and now she did kick the wall, making me flinch.
Then you should have stayed away. He hurt his last boyfriend, too. He hurts everyone, so they leave.
Oh, God. I had no hope of untangling that. Layers of perception and interpretation and implication about people I hardly knew in a situation I only partially understood. I left because we had an argument and I thought he didn't want me here. But it was a moderately sized misunderstanding and we've sorted it out now. She glared at me.
I had to ring him.
Ring who?
Caspian. I don't like having to ring my brother. Because I couldn't find you. He told me it was none of my business.
Wow. That was a seriously dick move on Caspian's part. Which was when I got it. I'd hurt her. Or rather, I'd acted like she was irrelevant to me, and that had allowed her own stupid-head brother to hurt her. It was a realization that helped banish a lot of my own frustration. I'm so sorry. Of course it was your business. We've only hung out once. I don't care where you go or what you do. You know, I'm not going to leave, Ellery. Now I'd figured out what was happening, it was easy to ignore what she was actually saying and try to address what she meant. Or at least what I thought was bothering her.
That's what Nathaniel said.
Nathaniel. Again. It was all I could do to keep myself gruntled. Yeah, well, I'm not him. I seem to be saying that a lot these days. He promised he'd always be there for me. Ellery drove her boot even more viciously at the poor defenseless, very expensive wall. I sat down on the edge of the bed in the hope that it might encourage her to stop and sit down too. It didn't.
You got on with him, then? He was okay?
From Ellery, this was practically a declaration of undying devotion. And God, when was I going to stop getting all freaked out over Nathaniel? Every time I heard his name, I got skewered by this spike of bad feels. Sort of general dislike and, well, I guess it was some relation of jealousy.
this nasty sense of always following in his footsteps. I fully intended to be a mature grown-up about it. Unfortunately, what came out of my mouth was, "Did he go to many raves with you?" Ellery glanced up, her eyes as sharp and bright as her sudden grin. Apparently, in being sullen and pathetic, I'd said the right thing. Somehow. "No." She finally stopped beating up the apartment. Slinking back into the room, she flumped onto the floor, knees pulled up to her chin so she was a grumpy knot of boots and legs and elbows. "We did other stuff. It was, I don't know, like having a proper brother. But Caspian fucked it up." I didn't want to argue with Ellery. But at the same time, I wouldn't have been much of a friend if I twiddled my thumbs while she said unreasonable shit. "You wanted your brother to stay with a guy who didn't make him happy. Nathaniel was good for him." "By what metric?" She glared at me and I knew I was pushing my luck. But I continued anyway. "Look, it's really hard to understand relationships from the outside. And besides, you're being super inconsistent right now."
"Super inconsistent?"
she repeated with a sarcastic little lilt. "Well, either you hate Caspian, in which case you wouldn't care whether he's with someone good for him. Or maybe you do care about him at least a little bit. And either Nathaniel was your friend, in which case Caspian should have been irrelevant, or he wasn't." Okay, that hadn't quite gone to plan. "Shit. Sorry, that sounds bad." She was tugging at the buckles on her boots, making them catch and clink.
"He said it was too complicated. And painful. Hanging out with me when he wasn't. Oh, whatever. Doesn't matter. Caspian takes everything. He always has."
I couldn't keep arguing with her about people I didn't know and a past that wasn't mine, so I changed tack. Gave her something I did understand, and could guarantee. "He won't take me."
"Yeah, right.
It's true. Chicks before dicks." She gave me a swift, sardonic look from beneath the tangles of her hair.
"He's definitely that.
And I'm really sorry I went running off to Scotland without telling you. I was just messed up and confused. I promise I won't do it again. At least, I won't if you give me your phone number so I can communicate with you instead of waiting for you to randomly turn up."
"Whatever."
But she tossed her iPhone at me. I added my name to her address book and sent myself a text before passing a mobile back. There was a slightly awkward silence. She fiddled with her phone a while. It had a gorgeous mother-of-pearl case that glinted with its own soft rainbows when it caught the light. Not very Ellery. Or maybe very Ellery. It was hard to tell sometimes.
"So,"
she glanced up at last. "Wanna shoot some people?" I made a gurgling noise. She watched me for a little while, and then the corner of her mouth ticked up into a smirk.
"I don't like Mondays, but not in a mass murder way. I meant on the PS4.
The last time I fired up the epic flat screen in the sitting area had been when Nick was staying. Because, the thing was, home cinema felt ridiculously fucking lonely if there was only you. "Sure," I said. We got ourselves settled on the sofa and Ellery got everything set up, finally tossing the second controller into my lap. We played some kind of Call of Duty alike. Actually, it probably was Call of Duty. And I was basically terrible, dropping grenades on my own feet, banging into Ellery's character and wincing every time I had to shoot a person-based collection of pixels. By contrast, she was positively surgical, cutting through our enemies, headshot by headshot by headshot. When she wasn't laughing at me, anyway. She had a good laugh, throaty and uninhibited, just rarely seen in the wild. Strangely, it was when she most reminded me of Caspian. I ordered a pizza at the point that a sensible food-having time rolled around. It was Ellery's choice, though she only ate a slice and then did coke off the box. "Problem?" she asked, catching me staring. "No, I mean, drugs are bad, aren't they?" "This isn't bad. It's some of the purest shit you can get." She swung her legs up onto the sofa and sprawled out, lazy as an alley cat who had beaten up all the other alley cats and nicked the best spot in the sun. "Sure you don't want some?" I shook my head. "Aren't you worried you'll get addicted, or your nose'll fall off or something?" "No. They'll send me back to rehab before I go full Winehouse." "Good to know." We were quiet for a bit. It was probably the longest I'd ever seen Ellery sit still. "Why do you do it?" I blurted out, sounding like Squarey McSquareson, the squarest square in Squareville, the only place in the universe they still said square.
"Do what?"
"You know."
"Oh, you mean getting tweaked, getting geeked, blowing out, making it snow, hitting a bump, chillin' with my white bitches."
I pouted. "I feel mocked and derided."
"You should, because that's what's happening to you."
"It's not a completely unreasonable question," I mumbled.
"It's boring, which is worse.
I do it because it feels good, obviously. But it's not real."
"Have you noticed nobody ever says that about the shitty stuff?"
I hadn't thought of it like that. She gave one of her "I'm almost too apathetic to express my apathy" shrugs.
"Life is just another come-down. Least this way I get to choose."
"Steady on." She'd managed to put me off the pizza. Apparently pepperoni didn't go with ennui. "There must be something else that makes you happy."
"Like what?"
A beautiful sunset?" She shot me a look from beneath her half-closed eyes, this sliver of greenish malice.
"A beautiful sunset? What the fuck is wrong with you?"
I panicked, okay? No reply. Wow. In less than 10 minutes, I'd achieved an almost 100% fun-to-awkward conversation rate. Go me. Ellery swung her boots off the sofa and stood up.
"I'm going now."
A glance out the nearest window confirmed it was late and dark. And maybe cold. "You can crash here if you like. I promise not to keep saying stupid things."
"Got somewhere to be."
That could have meant anything from shooting up in the toilets of a 24-hour McDonald's or floating down the Thames in a bag. Although probably she was just on her way to some kind of soul-crushingly trendy party. Anyway, I wasn't her keeper. She'd had enough of those already.
"You can come if you like,"
she offered. Admittedly, One Hyde Park wasn't the most homey of places. But at least I was allowed to hang out there in my underpants. Once I've engaged in pajama mode, I'm kind of locked in.
"I get it. Pajamas are dangerously cozy. Fuck pajamas."
And with that, she was gone. Since I'd fallen into that weird space where it was too early to go to bed and too late to do anything useful, like attempt to have a career, I decided to fix my toes. Marshalling my bottles of nail polish, I got rid of the remains of the Sally Bowles experiment and repainted in alternating sparkly purple and silver. While I was glad Caspian couldn't see me, hunched unattractively over my own feet like something from a National Geographic pullout, I was hoping he'd appreciate the end result. After all, he told me in Kinloch Bearvey that he found my taste in self-decoration distracting.
which, now I thought about it, didn't sound all that flattering. But the way he'd said it... Oh, God, the way he'd said it. Instamelt. Proud of my handiwork, but also conscious that Caspian might not be up for a barrage of needy selfies, I sent it to Nick. Nothing. Boo. And here I thought Nick could always be depended upon to find me cute on demand. What time was it in Boston anyway? 8? 9? A quick social media stalk soon revealed he was in the on-campus pub with some of his MIT friends. They looked like they were having fun, huddled round a rickety table and drinking what was probably craft beer. It gave me a weird pang for my barely over university days, though it was mainly the sense of community I missed, not so much the whole being expected to get a degree in English thing. At that moment my phone buzzed. It was Nick.
Sorry, crap reception. Adorbs?
I sent him back a kissy face, feeling mildly bad for having interrupted his evening with my feet, and then went to bed. Lounged around on the edge of sleep, wanking idly and thinking about Caspian. About Friday, which was forever away. Though, actually, while I generally preferred my gratification undelayed, it wasn't too bad waiting for Caspian like this. Knowing I meant something to him and that he wanted to be with me as much as I wanted to be with him, there was no more nervy uncertainty, just a warm flutter of anticipation. Maybe we'd be able to spend the whole weekend together. A prospect so sweet it made my newly bright toes curl as I came. Chapter 7. I spent the next day glued to my email. Just in case Milieu were all, "We loved your article so much, we got in touch with you straight away, even though that literally never happens." It hadn't happened. So I dedicated myself to being moderately productive, which mainly involved restocking my food supplies and writing, and only fretting about Milieu slash daydreaming about Caspian a little bit. Nick woke up hungover in the middle of my afternoon, and we long-distance buddy-watched an episode of Supergirl, me curled on the sofa. Nick apparently still in bed and not consistently conscious. I was back in the study and back at work, go me, when Ellery said, "Come on, we're leaving." "Oh my God!" I finished having a minor heart attack. "Are you ever going to, like, knock or warn me before turning up?" She thought about it for a moment.
"No."
"But what if you get here and I'm bonking your brother?"
"Then I'll be psychologically traumatized and you should feel bad about yourself."
I abandoned that line of argument as a dud and asked instead, "Where are we going?"
"I told you. Out."
I glanced at the time on my phone, surprised at how quickly the day had passed. I damn near worked a 9-to-5, if you discounted the fact I'd gone shopping, watched TV, and not got up at 9. But, you know, I was definitely getting there. "Okay, okay." I close my laptop. "Let me get changed." Ellery's own outfit, an off-the-shoulder jumper that simply said, "Dead," a floral skirt, black tights, docks and a backpack with cat skeletons on it, didn't offer much insight into possible destinations. It suggested something fairly casual, but knowing Ellery, that was probably how she dressed for tea with the Queen. I settled for jeans and my Boy George t-shirt, another present from Nick. It was just a stylized eye, very blue with the familiar slash of a brow, a touch of makeup and a single-colored tear sliding from the corner. I mean, the Queen liked Boy George, right? She'd offered him an OBE once. Well, allegedly. I flung my velvet jacket over the top, grabbed my phone, and that was me ready to go. We headed out of the building and down into the street. It was actually shaping up to be a fairly nice evening. Not exactly warm, because, you know, England, but the sky was swirly blue and a pale silver orb was hanging in it. I'd seen pictures of such a thing on the internet, and I think it was the sun. Ellery produced a pair of dark glasses and put them on. They were huge and round and covered her from brows to scowl. Thus protected from the merest hint of summer, she led me into Hyde Park through the Albert Gate. At least, I thought it was the Albert Gate. It was sandwiched between a couple of embassies, wide enough to admit a carriage, and there were weird statues of animals on either side of it, which struck me as the sort of thing Victoria was liable to stick her husband's name on. It led to a sandy avenue lined by hazy green trees, broken up every now and again by wrought iron lampposts. "Rotten Row," I said, getting all excited. Ellery turned her head slightly in my direction. "It's not that bad. Are you seriously telling me there's something I know about London that you don't?" She didn't answer, so I took that as a grudging yes and went on. "The name's a corruption of Route de Rome, and it was the fashionable place for ladies and gentlemen to ride out during the Regency period." "I'm not into rich people shit." Spoken like a true rich person. That earned me another head turn, but her mouth wasn't quite as sulky as usual. In fact, I would have even gone so far as to say her expression was amused. "How do you know this stuff?" she asked. "Georgette Heyer. Obviously." "Oh." I couldn't see her eyes, but her tone suggested they were rolling. "Romances. What's wrong with romances? And don't give me some line about them being trashy or patriarchal or always having the same plot, because everything always has the same plot." "No. They're just about people. Can't be fucked with people." The righteous wind wheezed out of my sails. "Aren't all books fundamentally about people? Watership Down is about rabbits. Allegorical people rabbits, though." "No, it isn't. They have their own language and faith and culture and think about things totally differently." I wasn't sure if I generally outraged her with my thoughts on Watership Down. So I did a conciliatory backpedal for the sake of social harmony. And also because I'd never heard her sound so passionate. And it was kind of adorable. "I guess. And anyway, that book is really fucked up." She grinned. "Isn't it?" We walked on in silence. Turned left at the tennis courts and ended up back on the Kensington Road between the Albert Memorial and the Royal Albert Hall. This part of London was basically a non-con Albert sandwich, whichever way you went. "Come on." Ellery stomped off purposefully, looping round to the south side of the concert hall. I'd never actually been this close to it before. It was a tiered cake of a building in red brick and terracotta, wrapped up in this decorative frieze about the advancements of arts and science and works of industry of all nations. I knew that because it was written right there in huge shiny letters. You had to love the Victorians. I mean, apart from the colonialism and the bigotry and the widespread social oppression. Okay, maybe the Victorians sucked. Once we got to what I guess was the front, it was clear something epic was going on. There were two lines of people running down each side of the Queen's steps, and from the general relaxed atmosphere, there were even little clumps of picnickers. It looked like everyone was in for the long haul. It was probably the most British thing I'd ever seen. Because say what you will about us as a nation, we sure as hell give good cue. Up near the front on the right was a little group all playing cards. Though they stopped when Ellery approached, and an older woman, with a cluster of white curls, got up from a fishing stool in order to, OMG, hug her. and Ellery didn't flip out or bite anyone. It was super weird. "This is Arden," Ellery said when she was finally released. "Arden, this is Flossie, Dick, Mikhail, Janet and John." I waved a little awkwardly since I had no idea what these people had to do with each other or with Ellery. With the exception of Mikhail, they were all in their 50s at least. John, in his tweedy elbow patch sporting jacket, looked like an academic. And Janet, like the subject of a Jenny Joseph poem. Dick peered up from the latest George R. R. Martin.
"Where've you been, Ellery girl? We thought you'd forgotten us."
"Just been busy."
"You've missed out."
"Oh yeah? Highlights?"
Flossie reclaimed her seat.
"This German couple took Mishka's spot, but we soon had them put to rights."
"I meant," said the alien who had replaced Ellery, "musically."
"The Halle, I think. Gave us some smashing Mahler."
Ellery shrugged. Now that was more like her.
"Das Lied."
They nodded.
Every time I hear that, I'm like, hurry up and die already. Don't hang there in D forever.
John was polishing his glasses on the edge of his sleeve.
"We should have guessed our lonely, half-forgotten Bella would draw you out."
Another Ellery shrug.
"Did you know he was supposed to have composed much of that piece while at a nudist camp?"
"Look that up on Wikipedia, did you?"
John's forehead went pink as the others laughed.
"Anyway," Ellery pulled out her phone and checked the time. "We'd better get going. Got our own queue to join."
"Oh, great. We're queuing as well." My face must have reflected something of my feelings on the subject because Dick smiled up at me.
"Never you mind, lad. It's part of the fun.
You should come with us one day,"
Flossie was saying to Ellery.
"No, arenas for people who want to be part of something. Galleries for people who don't."
"You know you're always welcome."
Ellery smiled. And wow, she looked bizarrely sweet.
"Save me a heave."
"If you serve us a whore."
Then she caught me by the hand and dragged me off down the steps. And I couldn't say I was any more illuminated. Our queue led all the way from the west side of the hall, along the street and past the back of a church.
"We're good,"
Ellery announced, having sized it up.
"Are we?" "Oh, yes," said the lady in front of us. "I've been right at the bottom of Bremner Road and still got in."
Since something was clearly expected of me, I offered a slightly anxious, "Yay!" Ellery lowered herself to the ground, crossed her legs and pulled her backpack into her lap. Then began rummaging around inside it like Mary Poppins had gone seriously off the rails. Not really knowing what else to do, I plopped down next to her and pulled my knees up to my chin. A suspicion was not so much forming as being ominously confirmed. "Ellery," I asked, "are we at the proms?"
"Maybe."
"Why are we at the proms?" She shrugged. My knowledge of the proms was scanty, to put it mildly. They were an annual classical musical festival, and the last night of them was a big deal and would be shown on BBC Two or something, with much pomp and circumstance and fireworks. "I thought you weren't into rich people shit."
"Arden."
Ellery hooked her finger under her glasses and pulled them down her nose so I could receive the full force of her appalled look.
"Anyone can go to the proms. That's the whole point."
"But I don't know anything about classical music."
"It's not about knowledge."
"Right now it seems about my arse getting numb. How long do we have to wait?" There was a lengthy silence. Ellery took off her sunglasses and folded the arms with a click.
"I knew you wouldn't get it."
Should have seen that coming. I stifled a sigh. How can I get it? I said as gently as I could. When you won't tell me anything. Silence again.
Like... Ellery's newly naked eyes looked oddly vulnerable, their shades softened by the sunlight. Ever since 1890-something, the proms have been about making music available to the people who get told that shit isn't for them. All you have to do is turn up and pay a fiver. Well, it's 6 quid now. And you can go to a concert.
I risked a small smile. Wow. That's pretty cool.
She's right, said unasked-for-Q-Lady. This way you get to be a part of something that goes back over 100 years.
Ellery didn't exactly strike me as a raging traditionalist. I just don't know what we're doing here.
Because I like it, okay?
Her raised voice startled a couple of pigeons on a nearby wall, and they took to the skies with a crackle of wings.
And you asked. You asked what I liked, and I trusted you. So either fuck off and die, or have a strawberry.
Have a what?
A strawberry. I brought strawberries.
She wrenched open her backpack and pulled out a brown paper bag.
Oh, don't mind if I do.
Unasked-for Q-Lady leaned over me and helped herself. Well, maybe I won't fuck off and die, I said. Ellery was still flushed and full of scowls.
Yeah, whatever. I'm sorry. Yeah, whatever.
Can I have a strawberry? I made my cutest face. For a moment, I thought she was going to say no, but then she relented.
Oh, all right.
It was probably the closest to forgiveness I was ever going to get. And the strawberry tasted amazing. Sparkly, sweet, and bright as the juice exploded over my tongue.
What are we here to see?
Here, I asked.
Bluebeard's castle.
I shouldn't know that. Right. Unasked for Q-Lady gave a little hop.
You're in for such a treat, love.
Ellery just put her sunglasses back on, her lips curving into an unreadable smile. Chapter 8. What had started out as the worst queuing experience of my life gradually became one of the best. Not that in all honesty there was that much competition. The evening got a flood of last-minute warmth, like a guilty start from the sun just as it was slipping away. I lay with my head on Ellery's lap, and she fed me the rest of the strawberries, at least the ones she could wrest from unasked-for Q-Lady. I couldn't help but notice that lots of other people were drinking wine, but Ellery had gone all ascetic on me and only brought water. Probably it was the right call. I wasn't sure whether my capacity to appreciate classical music would be improved or diminished if I was wankered. And besides, I was slightly floaty anyway, on the balmy evening air and the brush of heat across my skin, and the strange liberation of having nothing to do but wait. We were briefly interrupted by the click-whir-flash of a camera, and I startled out of a not-quite-daydream to find a... Well, there was no nice way to say it, a twitchy rat-like man in a leather jacket taking photos of us from the other side of the street.
"New boyfriend, Ellie!"
he called out.
"A friend," she threw back. "Now fuck off! Aren't you gonna introduce me?" "Oh, sure. This is Billy Boyle, an independent photojournalist, and this..."
She flapped a laconic hand in my direction.
"Is none of your fucking business."
"You know, I'll find out anyway."
"And you know, I'll set your car on fire."
"I love it when you get feisty."
He gave a frankly creepy shiver.
"Okay, fine. How about you fuck off now and I'll be at Tansy Storburton's 21st on Friday? You'll make it worth my while.
I'm hurt.
Ellery gave a magnificent yawn. It's like you don't know me at all.
Boyle grinned with sharp teeth.
I'll be watching.
Yeah, yeah. Try not to get cancer.
Unasked for Q-Lady had listened to the exchange with unabashed curiosity. As soon as Boyle had oozed away, she turned to Ellery and asked excitedly,
Are you famous?
No.
Ellery settled her sunglasses more firmly on her nose.
I'm notorious.
A couple of fairly relaxed hours later, there was a judder down the line of people, which was snaking so far beyond us I couldn't see the end anymore. And we were moving. Funneled with surprising efficiency through door 10 and into the Royal Albert Hall, Ellery, who had a crumpled tenner and £2 coins already in hand, paid for me. Then there were stairs. A lot of stairs. No, really, so many stairs. We finally emerged, me wheezing and Ellery barely winded, onto the gallery. It was kind of otherworldly. A corridor of gleaming stone that curled gently around the entire hall. Ellery dragged me into a space between two decorative pillars and, oh God, we were high! The tiers of seats sloping away from us so sharply it made me feel like I was about to topple over. Even though what I was actually doing was clinging to the rail as if I was on a roller coaster. Down in the... Was it still a mosh pit if you were in a concert hall? Anyway, the people jiggling about down there were pinheads, and the orchestra might well have been a flea circus. Other prommers were filtering in behind us and around us, and there was a bit of jostling for the best spaces. But it didn't feel crowded at all, especially in comparison to the audience below, who looked like hundreds and thousands tossed too liberally over an ice cream sundae. Ellery was stretched out on a travel rug, her backpack tucked under her head.
You sitting down?
But I won't be able to see.
It's music. You listen.
A quick glance around us confirmed that, while some people had chosen to stand by the railing, others had brought cushions and blankets of their own. No wonder Ellery liked it here. It was its own secret world. After a moment or two, I lay down beside her and rested my head against her shoulder. Considering we were about to spend an hour or more on a stone floor, it was pretty comfortable. And I could still see through the gaps in the railing, mainly the arches on the other side of the gallery, which shone faintly gold, and the strange discs hanging from the ceiling. It's like an alien planetscape, I said, pointing.
They're for the acoustics. Apparently there used to be an echo, so they put those up in the 60s.
It made sense. Giant floating ceiling mushrooms. The solution you'd come up with if you were high on LSD and sexual liberation. Various noises floated up to us. The jingle thonks of an orchestra getting ready and the rustle creaks of an audience settling down. The lights slowly began to dim.
Hang on.
Ellery thrust a bundle of papers at me.
I brought you a libretto.
You what? And then a deep voice broke across the darkness. Once upon a time, where did this happen? Was it outside or within? Once upon a time there was an old story. But what does it mean, my lords and fine ladies? The song begins and you watch me watching you, the curtains of your eyelids raised. But where is the stage? Is it outside or within us, my lords and fine ladies? The music crept through the words, twisted round them like ivy. A gathering sense of foreboding sobbed softly over cello strings. Then clarinets, violins, and oh, I was there. In a dark castle where the walls wept and the air tasted of blood.
It turned out only the prologue was in English, and the rest was, something else. But Ellery was right. I didn't need the libretto. Not when I had two voices and a whole orchestra to tell me a too familiar fairy tale of love and pain. Despite being up in the gallery, I didn't feel far away from the music at all. I felt surrounded by it, suffused by it. Like I'd taken emotional heroin and nothing I would experience from this moment forward could ever be so pure a hit. It was perfect. It was overwhelming. It was ridiculously fucking numinous. The bit in the middle, when Judith opened the fifth door to reveal Bluebeard's kingdom, and the orchestra just exploded as if the music itself was light, and the mezzo-soprano hit a note I had no idea humans were capable of producing, I honestly thought my heart would burst. And afterward, when the sixth door revealed a lake of tears, I started crying, too, almost without realizing I was. I liked it, is what I'm saying. And when it was over, and Judith had taken her place among the other wives, and everything was dark again, there was this moment of absolute silence, followed by a storm of stamping, and then rapturous applause. I lay back and tried to remember how to do ordinary things like breathing and thinking and functioning. Ellery still had her eyes closed, one arm flung above her head. There was something oddly abandoned about the pose. Not exactly sexual, because God knows I didn't want to think of Caspian's sister like that. But content, maybe. "Well?" she asked. I gave a shaky laugh, because there was only one answer, really. It was so good I nearly peed my pants. "Come on," she grabbed my hand. "Let's get out of here before we get Debussy'd. Can't stand that syrupy shit." I was slightly dazed as I followed Ellery out of the Royal Albert Hall and into the lingering warmth of the night. We wandered silently between the pale white mansions and red brick towers of Kensington, letting the memory of the music linger. Next time I paid attention to my surroundings, we were on the old Brompton Road. This was the closest Kensington got to having a commercial district. But it was still Kensington, so that meant incredibly posh flats. Boutiques that sold nothing anybody would reasonably want to buy. Upmarket restaurants, unnecessarily large branches of Pret-a-Manger, and somewhere in the middle of it all, the pub where Private Eye was founded. Ellery grabbed my hand and pulled me into a late-opening gelato parlour, so dinky that I probably would have walked straight past it if I'd been on my own. The sight of the long counter with the different ice cream flavours all fluffed up like perfect little clouds and as bright as birds of paradise made me legit squeak. It earned me a dubious look from Ellery. "You okay?" "OMG! I flailed like a Disney princess about to go to the ball. Yes, yes, yes!" "Because you look like you're about to die." "I have died, and I've gone to heaven." Ellery was still mid-facepalm as I hustled over to the menu. "What's best?" I asked, jumping up and down. "What do you recommend?" "It's all fine." It's the sort of place where they told you exactly where everything came from. Grand Cru chocolate, Channel Island milk, Chilean sultanas, where even the pistachios were superior. And so, of course, I wanted to eat everything. Ellery ordered a chocolate cone of green tea gelato, though they called it Te Verde. And I finally overcame my greed paralysis enough to get the stracciatella, since, as far as I was concerned, the only thing better than chocolate or vanilla was when you were allowed to have chocolate and vanilla together. There might have been a moral in there somewhere. The place was nearly empty, what with it being close to 9 on a Tuesday. So we sat in the bay window and stuffed our faces. At least, I stuffed my face. Ellery ate ice cream with the same air of mild contempt she brought to everything. Well, everything except music, as I'd learned today. "Thank you for this," I said. "It's been the best." She shrugged.
"Yeah."
So, I chased a curl of chocolate with the edge of my spoon. "Any particular reason for that opera?"
"Maybe I just like the music."
"And the story was irrelevant." She gave me a look I couldn't quite read. Her eyes greener than they were blue in this softer light, and less like Caspian than usual.
"Well, what do you think?"
At this rate, we would be here all night, like the vultures in the Jungle Book. I broke cover. "I think Judith chose her fate."
"Huh. Interesting. Because I think she married a psycho who murdered her."
"I think," I squirmed, "it's a touch more ambiguous than that.
He has a torture chamber in his head.
But also a lake of tears." She crunched off the end of her cone.
"Probably from the people he's tortured."
"Or maybe it's all him. His own pain and grief and darkness. The wives could represent the hopes and dreams he's lost."
"Or maybe some castles are dark and there's nothing you can do about it."
"Except, you know, except the castle is dark. Instead of worrying about how it isn't light."
"Whatever."
Ellery pulled out her phone and checked the time.
"Okay, I've got to go."
I glanced at my half-finished ice cream and then at the counter, wondering if I had room for another scoop. Because, fuck me, this stuff was amazing. So rich and sweet and sharp, all at the same time. I might stay here for the rest of my life. For a moment, I thought she was going to say something. But she just stood there, idly kicking at the leg of her chair. "It's not like Caspian is going to murder me," I said.
"Yeah, but maybe you deserve a nicer castle."
And with that, she picked up her backpack and disappeared into the night, leaving me with my stracciatella and some slightly tangled thoughts about my relationship, which quickly unraveled into me missing Caspian. Wanting to hold his hand across the table, share a milkshake with him, lick the sweetness from his mouth. That was the thing about billionaire non-boyfriends, though. They could do anything, be anything, reshape the whole fucking world, but you'd probably always be left eating ice cream by yourself. Chapter 9. My Instagram account, which I only intermittently remembered to update, had been a lot more lively since @i_hate_Ellery had started tagging me. But I woke up to find it was going notify crazy, with no intervention from her at all, which, given that my last post had been a suggestive butternut squash I'd seen at the farmer's market down on Butte Street, meant something else was going on. Cringing, I opened Google and fed it my own name. Not a bean beyond my usual stuff, social media accounts I'd forgotten about and some of the articles I'd written. With an increasingly swallowed live lizard feeling in my stomach, I tried Eleanor Hart. And boom. In every afternoon tea and gossip magazine from Hello to Goodbye, there we were. Me with my head in Ellery's lap as she fed me a strawberry in a fashion that, to those unfamiliar with the inherent sensuality of my strawberry-eating technique, probably looked a bit intimate. The byline was mostly something like, "Notorious wild child Eleanor Hart spotted with new mystery man at proms." Because the internet murdered brevity the way video killed the radio star. For a few minutes, I just
stared, tried to figure out how I was feeling. If I was scared or angry or violated or confused or all of them. Because if my Instagram was anything to go by, the mystery man ship had sailed. Had way sailed. What the hell was I supposed to do? Only one thing for it, really. I rang Belrose. He picked up, swiftly as ever. Arden, I don't know if this is something I should be bothering you with. Well, neither will I unless you tell me. It's on the internet. Google Ellery. Then came the tap of his keyboard and a thoughtful silence. Followed by, Are you at the apartment? Yes, I'll be there in an hour. I wasn't sure if that made me feel better or worse. In any case, it called for trousers. Unfortunately, getting dressed couldn't last me 60 minutes, and so by the time Belrose turned up, I was in knots. Am I in trouble? I blurted out, the moment he was over the threshold. Of course not. I wanted you to meet someone. He stepped aside to reveal a slight, elegant stiletto of a man. This is Alexander Finesilver of Gisborne, Finesilver and King. He's the Hart's lawyer. In all honesty, I didn't find this very reassuring. Okay. Among other things, he specializes in media litigation and reputation management. Finesilver smiled at me. And wow, he was good at smiling. It was positively bounteous. Warm, genuine, everything you could possibly want in a friendly baring of teeth.
I hope you'll contact me directly if you have any concerns like this again.
And the next thing I knew, he was holding his business card, which was pearl grey and gold, at once opulent and discreet. I'm actually pretty concerned right now, I said.
Understandably, Mr. St. Ives.
Another smile. It was hard to get the measure of him. Probably because most people seemed ordinary when Belrose was standing there like the ridiculous golden Ganymede he was. But Finesilver practically courted it. To shuck your curiosity like water. Pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. A few minutes later they were huddled around a laptop on the dining table while I hovered anxiously nearby.
I don't suppose... Finesilver glanced up. You remember anything about when or where these photographs were taken? Or by whom?
We were waiting for the proms, and it was only one guy. He was sleazy, and, wearing a leather jacket. Arden St. Ives, witness of the year. I think he had brown hair.
Sounds like Boyle.
I snapped my fingers. Yes, that was what Ellery called him. Can we try another injunction? Asked Belrose. I caught something in Finesilver's eyes, as real and sharp and frightening as the flash of the hidden blade. Everything his smile wasn't. But when he spoke, his tone was mild enough that I was tempted to convince myself I'd imagine what I'd seen.
It's difficult to make them stick when Miss Hart herself keeps breaking them.
Obsession can be quite attractive. Belrose cleared his throat. Also, I understand. He's not her friend. Do you think I haven't tried to tell her that? Great. I'd apparently opened my mouth and made words come out of it again. And now they were both staring at me like lions eyeing up a gazelle across the Serengeti. They didn't seem very friendly.
As I'm sure you're aware, murmured Finesilver, Miss Hart forms complex relationships with those around her.
I don't know. She did sort of tell him to get cancer and die. That doesn't strike me as super complex. Belrose's hand curled into a fist on the tabletop. Arden, this situation is delicate, and Ellery's entanglement with Billy Boyle long-standing.
We have put in place several measures to protect her from him, and in the end it is Ellery who has broken them all. He sounded frustrated. Not in the idle, commonplace way he got impatient with me sometimes. This was Thorn in poor helplessness. Though I didn't think it was for Ellery. Far more likely he was pissed off because there was something he couldn't fix and make neat for Caspian. There must be more to it, I said. I know there's aspects to the situation I don't understand. But Ellery's not... I mean, Ellery doesn't do things for no reason. Even if it's just her reason. Belrose's mouth thinned into a mean little line that didn't suit him. And Finesilver was still radiating an impenetrable field of, trust me, I'm a nice person. I believe she feels in some way connected to him. Because he follows her around taking candid photos of her. Because he has done so since she was 15 years old. And, he sighed gently, on one occasion got her to hospital after an overdose. Oh, Ellery. I wanted to hug the living daylights out of her, which she would have hated. I guess... I shuffled my feet awkwardly. He can't be all bad, then. Finesilver's only change of expression was the slight re-angling of a brow.
He took photographs first.
The matter at hand. Belrose turned the screen more toward Finesilver and even less toward me. Finesilver busied himself with the laptop again.
These are the only photographs circulating, and they don't appear to have been picked up by any major outlets. If we do nothing to suggest they might be worth attention, they will be less than flotsam in a day or two. And if not...
Then, said Finesilver mildly,
I will ensure there is something more newsworthy available to claim attention.
He could do that. Ah, of course he could do that. So, it's okay? I asked. He nodded.
I believe so, though I will continue to monitor the situation.
And Caspian isn't cross. Uncomprehending silence. I mean, I babbled on, he might not like it if people thought I was, you know, dating his sister. Belrose gave me one of his coolest looks. He is quite aware of the vagaries of the gutter press. Okay, good. Well, not good, but... Though it's possible he might be less circumspect if he thought you were upset. Something I will not be communicating to him. His eyes were steady on mine and diamond sharp. Will you? Wow. He really did not think good things about me. Of course not. And I'm not actually upset. Just worried Caspian might see it and not like it. Arden, are you labouring under the misapprehension that he spends his afternoons Googling you? I could have pointed out that Caspian had stalked both my Facebook and my Instagram feed looking for me. But I didn't. Because I had dignity. And then Finesilver slips back into the conversation with the grace of a fencer.
There's only one potential cause for concern here. And that is if details about Mr. St. Ives came to light that would perhaps be better left unilluminated.
I wasn't sure I liked the sound of that. What kind of details?
Oh, anything that could be perceived in particular ways.
What he means, explained Belrose, is have you done anything illegal, embarrassing, or scandalous? Embarrassing and or scandalous covered about 80% of my life, and probably the remaining 20% was me being asleep. But it also didn't seem like the sort of embarrassing or scandalous that sold copy. I mean, I fell over in front of billionaires a lot. Did that count? Not really.
Are there any secrets you shouldn't be keeping? Any skeletons in your closet?
Well, there was my dad. But he wasn't so much a skeleton in my closet as a bogeyman.